Today's scripture reading will be from Proverbs chapter 31, verses 8 and 9. Proverbs chapter 31, verses 8 and 9. Open thy mouth for the dumb in the cause of all such as are appointed to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy.
I'd also like to thank everyone here for the well wishes, for the prayers, for the gifts, as Carissa and I have started this new chapter in our lives. Oh no, not again. One second. Nope. All right, we're going to see if this works. All right, could I get new batteries coming out here? Sorry about that, folks. You don't get to see a picture of Luke. Sorry. Could you give me some? Yeah. Oh, there he is. Okay. I'll probably need some. I don't know. Go ahead. Oh, you think it's good? Okay. All right. We'll see how it goes. Sorry about that. But here he is. I'm sorry you haven't gotten to meet him yet. The doctors were pretty strict about making sure he stays indoor. He stays away from a bunch of people, at least for a few weeks. Whenever he finally does get to come, I look forward to showing him off. He's a bundle of joy. He kept us up pretty late last night, but he's still a great bundle of joy. I love him. And as I went through this process of starting this new family with my wife, let's say having a son put certain things on my mind, especially going to the doctor's office week after week. We, in a very real way, got to know our son while he was still in the womb. I got to see him move for the first time through the ultrasound at 8 weeks. He was dancing like there was no tomorrow. It was a wonderful blessing to see him that first time. And then, later on, at 20 weeks, we got to see him sucking his thumb while in the womb. We got to find out which gender he was, and we found out, okay, he's a boy, and we could see that he was moving around, he was opening and closing his hands. We would feel his kicks against his mommy's tummy, and when we'd shine a light on her tummy, he would stop. Because he sensed the light, he could see it, he knew something was going on. In fact, he still does that. He still will pause if we turn on the lights or if we blow in his face. As we were having a hoot last night, just blowing in his face. But anyway, that's beside the point. But in a very real way, we got to know him. We got to a sense of his personality before he was ever out of the womb. And I couldn't help but wonder, in this whole joyous process, I couldn't help but have my mind turn toward darker subject matter. I couldn't help but wonder, how could anyone hurt a child? How could anyone kill their own child? This subject has been on my mind for months. It's been grating at my soul. And maybe you've been thinking about it lately. It's definitely been in the news. Maybe you saw, I think it was about a week and a half ago, the March for Life had just taken place. Thousands of people braved the cold weather to go to Washington, D.C. and demonstrate their support for life. And they, well, it was freezing cold, but they were there, and there were tens of thousands. It's considered to be one of the largest, if not the largest, event or public display that's going on an annual basis. Sadly, you probably didn't see much about that. You probably saw more about what was going on in New York. In New York State, to standing ovation in the state Senate, the governor signed into law it's called the Reproductive Health Act. What does this law do? It makes it legal to abort your child up until the due date, up until they're out of the womb, if the pregnancy is, proves to be a risk to the mother's life or health. And that term health there is purposefully left vague. It's purposefully undefined, and it could mean anything from social health to financial health to physical health. In response to this law, there was a standing ovation. It was ordered that World Trade Center 1, Liberty Tower, be lit up pink as a sign to everyone at the great state, what the great state of New York was doing. Now, if you're thinking it's strange that all of this is kind of taking place at once, you're just like me, okay? Because this has been a thought that's been on my mind. It's been grating at me, but I haven't known what to do about it. I haven't known how to express my turmoil over this. And over the last several months, it's just been eating away at me until the last 2 weeks. All of this has been happening at once. And the truth is, the reason for that is because 46 years ago, on January 22nd, which is the day that this law was signed into, the day that this was signed into law, it was 46 years ago that Roe v. Wade was signed. And if you don't know what that is, Roe v. Wade is the Supreme Court decision that made abortion legal in all states. It made it a federal legality. And so in kind of celebration of Roe v. Wade, they signed this new bill on that anniversary. So, of course, it's all happening at once. And again, I was thinking about this, and I was wondering, what do I do about it? Do I preach about it? Do I not preach about it? Do I talk about it? You know, is it a problem to talk about in mixed company? What should I do? And as I was debating all of this, and I've been debating it for a little while, I open up the text that I've been assigned for this week. In Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 through 22. And after reading this text, I decided, you know what, I'm not going to wrestle with God anymore. I'm going to talk about this. Because it seems to me that I need to. It seems to me that He wants me to. If you are aware, the new theme for the year is He can and He will, taken from the book of Exodus. We've been talking a lot about what God is able to do. Last week we introduced this theme. Now, I invite you to read with me, starting in verse 8. It says, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal wisely with them, or else they will multiply. And in the event of war, they will also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from this land.' So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh the storage cities Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously. And they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks and at all kinds of labor in the field, all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them." So a new king rises up over Egypt and he doesn't remember Joseph. He doesn't remember the good that has been brought to Egypt by the Israelites. Maybe he never knew. Maybe it hasn't been brought to his attention. It's very possible he was a new king who had taken control as a new regime. And so he didn't know about Joseph. And no one felt it necessary to inform him. So he sees this people of Israel as a threat. He sees them all as this one race, and he degrades them. I think later verses you can see that he kind of considers them to be less than human. He views them as this enemy, this threat that is, let's say, a dark cloud hanging over Egypt. So what does he do? He puts them into slavery. He commits this great evil of putting an entire people into bondage. And yet in that bondage, God still blesses the people of Israel. They still multiply. They still grow strong. And this Pharaoh is still terrified of them. Verse 15, it says, "Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other was named Puah. And he said, when you are helping the Hebrew women to give birth and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall put him to death. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. He's afraid of the people of Israel. So he enacts this plan. And he brings in these midwives to fulfill his plan. And I don't want us to get confused by the wording here. It's most likely that these midwives were not Hebrew. It's most likely they were Egyptian. It was their task to be midwives for the Hebrews. But the evidence seems to point to the fact that they weren't Hebrews themselves. So he assumes they're going to be just as prejudiced as he is. He asks them to come in and he says, I want you to murder these boy babies. Why is that? Well, I think the purpose for kind of what he does here is probably twofold. On the one hand, it's possible to keep the murders a secret. If you're letting the baby come out and the mother's up here and is maybe focused over there, you can then check to see if it's a boy or girl, kill it if it's a boy, and then pretend that he died in labor. But of course, the other more for sure reason is because he wants to see whether or not it's a boy or a girl. And so he embarks upon this task of infanticide over these male children. He's afraid that these boys will grow up to be warriors, that they will turn against the Egyptians, right? And this is no different from what's been going on for many years in China and India, where millions of babies have been aborted for no other reason than because they're girls. In a society that deems a boy as more valuable than a girl, and also in a society where you're only allowed to have one child, it leads to a lot of baby girls being killed. And so the Pharaoh asks these people, these midwives, to perform this heinous act on his behalf. But look at verse 17. It's one of my favorite verses in all the Bible, I have to say. It says, but the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded them, but let the boys live. I love this verse. These women, who were most likely not Hebrews, they couldn't bear to kill these children. And I don't want us to neglect the reasoning that the text gives us for why they didn't do it. It doesn't say they didn't do it because they were squeamish or because they felt sick about it. It doesn't say that they just couldn't bear to do it, although those might have been factors. It says specifically they didn't do it because they feared God. They feared God rather than man, rather than Pharaoh. And Proverbs chapter 9, verse 10 says that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And I think in a very real sense, that's true. These women, they feared God, even though they weren't people of God. They weren't Israelites. And this phrase, they feared God, is often used in the Old Testament, especially when describing people who were not Israelites. So that's what I find so beautiful and interesting about this phraseology, is that so many times it's people who are not Israelites, people who are supposed to be idolatrous, people who are supposed to be outside of the understanding of God, and yet they had at least a deep enough understanding of right and wrong that they feared God rather than man. In other words, if you fear God rather than man, you're going to be willing to sacrifice things on this earth that you wouldn't otherwise be willing to sacrifice. These midwives, they were willing to sacrifice their freedom, their lives. Why? Because they knew what was right and they knew what was wrong. They feared retribution from God, from the judge. Even if they didn't have a true understanding of who that judge is, they feared that they would be in eternal jeopardy because they knew what was right and what was wrong. They feared God, and that led to this wisdom. Matthew 10, verse 28, Jesus says, do not fear those who can kill the body and cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both the soul and the body in hell. That's the fear we need to have. And it's not that we're shaking and trembling all the day that we feel like we're going to be judged for any little thing we do, but it is a healthy respect for the one who's in control. It's a healthy respect and healthy fear that we know what's right and wrong, and it comes from our judge. And so these midwives, they fear God, and for thus they are heroes. They are remembered even to this day in many Jewish cult or in many Jewish households. You might find a daughter named Shiphrah because she's named after this one of these midwives. These women are not forgotten; they're heroes. And again, God blesses them for this. Look at verse 18. Verse 18, it says, "So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this thing and let the boys live?' The midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwives can get to them.' So God was good to the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very mighty. Because the midwives feared God, he established households for them." These women are blessed because they feared God more than they feared Pharaoh. I wish the same could be said for the rest of the Egyptians. Verse 22. Pharaoh has run out of options. So he does this. It says, "Then Pharaoh commanded all the people, saying, 'Everyone, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive.'" And of course, it is in this context that Moses is born, that Moses is saved by his mother, by his sister, by the Pharaoh's daughter. It is in this moment that the great retribution and the great salvation of Israel is going to start through Moses and in this horrible event. In fact, in chapter 2, verses 23 through 25, we read that God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. God remembered what was going on. It didn't escape his notice, and God was planning a retribution. Make no mistake, Egypt was judged by God for their sin. It came in terrible plagues. It came in fire and brimstone. It came in the destruction of their armies. It came in the death of the firstborn in every family. God's vengeance was terrible. And make no mistake, it was for the crimes that they had committed. All it takes for evil to prosper. Maybe you can finish the sentence. For good men to do nothing. This very idea has been grating on me. As I said, every time I drive home from this building, I would pass by an abortion clinic on my way home. And I'd wonder, what am I doing? Am I like a German in 1945 who passes by the concentration camp, maybe shakes his head in shame, and yet keeps on going? You know, I've heard so many people condemn the good people who did nothing. Is that me? These are moral questions that I don't have the answer for. I don't have the answer to. But I do know that I wanted to do something. But I ask myself, what can I do? I feel helpless. Because it's not that I do nothing for lack of caring. It's that I feel like there's nothing I can do. That this is an insurmountable problem. That this is for people who have more power and more resources than I. There's nothing I can do. But is that not just an excuse? Is that an excuse we afford to the Egyptians who stood by and let these Israelite babies get thrown into the Nile? I do believe God's judgment will come upon our nation. I don't know in what form. I don't know when. But the Holocaust, the Egyptian slaughter of the Israelites, by sheer numbers, we've left them behind in the rearview mirror. We're approaching nearly 1 million abortions a year. 1 million a year since 1973. I don't think we have to add up the numbers. So how can we be like the midwives in Exodus chapter 1? What power do we actually have? What can we do? Well, I think the first thing we can do is actually be more educated on what abortion is. Because abortion itself is a term that has been sterilized, and it's a sorry description of what is actually taking place. Now, I'm not going to be up here showing pictures. I'm not going to go into the graphic detail, although I do encourage every one of us to look that up on our own time. I do think it's necessary. It's important to understand, to pull the curtain aside and see what is actually taking place. We're not talking about a cluster of cells. We're not talking about taking someone off of life support. We're talking about the forceful termination of babies. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I want to clear the decks real quick before we get into some of these points of what we can do, how we can educate ourselves. I want to clear the decks. I want us to understand, first of all, that this is not a political discussion. Although this subject has been politicized, I want you to know I'm not up here to discuss politics. I consider this to be, first and foremost, a moral issue. And yes, some of the discussion might go into the realm of politics. Some of the solutions to this problem might be in the realm of politics. The March for Life is itself, even though it was founded by believers and is kind of a grassroots movement through many Christians, it is a political movement. And in many ways, politics have become entwined with this subject. But I hope that we all understand, no matter where we fall on the political spectrum, we won't allow that to dictate what we believe on this matter. I'm going to ask all of us of that just right before we begin. I'm going to ask all of us to leave that baggage at the door and just listen to what this process, what this evil is. I'm going to do my best to make the moral case. Don't let it become a political one. Because I'm up here speaking as an outraged Christian and nothing else. There are no ulterior motives. So often, people of the pro-life movement are maligned and slandered as to having ulterior motives. And I think that that's a pity. I actually think it's a distraction. There's smoke screens that are thrown up so that we don't discuss the real issues at hand. You know, we're called, you know, crazy religious zealots if we're pro-life. We're anti, you know, science, which we'll see that that's just false in just a few minutes. We're against women. We're sexist in some way. We want to control women in some way. All of these are distractions, and they're not true. And if you think that these are in any way true, then you've bought into a lie. The abortion debate is very simple. It comes down to two questions. Number one, what is life? And number two, what value does life have? That's it. That's the argument. That's all there is to be discussed in this discussion. And yet so often people throw up distractions, people throw up smoke screens, and we can't actually discuss the real issue. Well, I want you to know right now, I don't have any ulterior motives. I believe it's life, and I believe that life has value, and that's my motive. Thirdly, I want us to understand that we're all motivated in love. We're speaking the truth in love here, as we are commanded to do so. God is the judge. I believe He will bring terrible judgment and retribution upon this nation, but that does not mean He has to bring down terrible judgment upon you individually. Even if you have gone into realms of darkness, even if you've committed sin, we've all committed sin. We've all fallen short of the glory of God. And even if you've performed an abortion, even if you've had an abortion performed on you. You can be forgiven by God's grace. I want to make that clear from the get-go. So now that we've cleared the decks, let's go ahead and again ask this question. What can we do? The first thing we need to do is stop buying into the prevailing narrative. Don't buy the lies. Now this is going to take up the bulk of our discussion. Because the truth is, there are a lot of answers I don't have. My main hope is that we can start a discussion together, that if you have ideas on what we can accomplish, that you'll discuss it with one another, with your brothers and sisters here. And some of you, this might be, in fact, most of you is probably preaching to the choir as I go over these arguments. But don't check out. Use this as a moment to educate yourselves. Use it as a moment to really consider what's being said on both sides. So again, even though this is probably a no-brainer for a lot of you, I think it's very important to make it extremely clear. Abortion is antithetical to the Christian worldview. Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 through 27, were just read to us a few minutes ago. We find that God created men and women in His own image. He created man and woman with an eternal soul. And that image, since we are created in God's image, that gives us value, an amazing value that is higher than the animals or the plants of this world. We have a higher and a greater value than all other creation God has made. He loves us so much that He sent His only Son to die on our behalf. I've heard many people say that Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27 are perhaps the most important verses in the Bible. Because it starts here. This is where we get our fundamental value of life. This is why we view humanity as valuable. That value comes from God. He granted it. It's nothing we can do, and it's nothing we can take away. It starts there. And when you go through the book of Genesis, you find that there is a logical conclusion to this fact. When you realize that humanity is made in God's image, you also realize that to take a life is, again, it's antithetical to the way of God. It is wrong. And I don't think I have to go too far on this point. I think we all understand that the Bible speaks against murder. I think we all understand that. There's no one here, I hope, there's no one here who's saying murder is all right, right? Even people who might be pro-abortion, they don't think murder is okay. The question then becomes, it goes back to those same two questions. Is it life? What is life? How do you define life? And then what is the value of that life? And so we have to ask, when does life begin? For a human being, for a person, when does life begin? At conception? At birth? Somewhere in between? Scientifically speaking, there's only one consistent answer that we can draw. There's only one consistent line we can draw, scientifically speaking. Imagine for a moment that you're talking to someone who doesn't believe in Scripture, you're talking to someone who doesn't believe in the Bible, and you're trying to convince them of the evil that is the murder of the unborn. You have to convince them through means that aren't Scripture. Scientifically speaking, the only consistent line you can draw is that conception. Let me explain. The pro-life movement this year, their theme was pro-life equals pro-science. The point being that the more science opens up a view into the womb, the more and more abortionists are standing on thin ice. Because we're getting a greater and greater understanding, a greater knowledge of what's going on as a baby is formed. And so let's talk about conception. At the point of conception, the egg is fertilized and has a completely separate DNA from the mother. Which, of course, flies in the face of the my body argument. If again, scientifically speaking, if we were to find a single-celled organism on Mars, what would be in the newspapers? Life! We found life on another planet! All the scientists would be discussing how amazing it is that we found life. Again, scientifically speaking, the only place you can draw the line is at conception. It has completely separate DNA from the mother. It is an organism that, and again, according to definitions on basic definitions, scientific definitions on life, it meets the category, it meets the criteria. It says, here's the definition of life: the condition that distinguishes animals and plants from inorganic matter, including the capacity for growth. What are they doing in there? They're growing. Reproduction. They are multiplying. Now, some might say, whoa, 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 they're not able to really reproduce. Neither is a child. Are we saying a child's not alive? We go on. Functional activity and continual change preceding death. By the very basic scientific definitions of life, if we were to call life, if we were to find this on Mars, we'd call it life. If we find it in the womb, it's life. It's still life. Now, again, it goes back to the second question. What is the value of this life? Some people will say, no, this life has no value because there's no consciousness. And again, all it takes is a little bit of logic to see that there's flaws in that. Again, you can't consistently draw the line at consciousness. Why? Because you ask, okay, what about someone who's in a coma? And they say, well, I think it'd be all right to pull the plug. But then you ask, okay, what if you knew that this person in the coma was going to wake up in, say, 9 months? Would it be okay to pull the plug then, kill them? And again, we're not talking about pulling the plug. We're talking about inserting poison. We're talking about dismemberment. We're talking about murder. The only consistent line you can draw, scientifically speaking, logically speaking, is at conception. We don't know when the soul comes. We don't know when God decides to form all of that. We do know that before we were born, He knew us. We do know that while we were in the womb, He saw us and He formed us, and we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And therefore, at least the potential for life, for a soul, for consciousness, should be enough that we back off and we say, I'm not God. I'm not going to put a stop to this. But let's go ahead and look at how the fetus continues to develop, how a baby is formed in the womb. Again, as science gives us more knowledge, the more we understand, the worse this looks, okay? What I'm going to do is go through the fetal development, and I'm going to stop at the point that California, the state of California, says, okay, this is the cutoff point, no more abortions. So I'm going to go through the development, and I'm going to stop when they say, okay, that's enough. But I want to be clear. I don't want to mince any words. Some states are worse. Some states are better. All states, it's legal. In California, there's already a law that is similar to New York's law. In other words, if the mother's health is at risk, and again, that term is very subjective, it could mean anything, then it's still possible to abort even after the cutoff point. But I'm going to stop at the cutoff point where at least it becomes difficult. You can't just do it for any reason. Okay? So let's talk about this. This is near and dear to my heart. I've just witnessed a lot of this myself. I've taken these images and a lot of these descriptions from a place called thebabycenter.com, which is like a pregnancy help center. And again, I can attest to it because I've witnessed a lot of this. At 5 weeks, the heart begins to beat. With Luke, this was the first time we saw him in the ultrasound. Or actually, I'm sorry, it was the first time we got to hear his heartbeat through a monitor that they put there. Most women are just realizing they're pregnant at this point, which makes it almost impossible to have an abortion before the heart is beating, before the blood is pumping. At 8 weeks, the baby is already moving around. With Luke, this is when we got to see him on the ultrasound. And I promise you, he was dancing like there was no tomorrow. He was moving around. He was kicking. In the state of California, still legal to murder. At 10 weeks, smaller details like fingernails are beginning to form. One of the most critical stages of development has been complete. It's still legal to murder. At 12 weeks, his or her reflexes are kicking in. Hands are beginning to open and close. He feels it when you poke him. A week later, at 13 weeks, he's already got his own fingerprints. If it's a girl, her ovaries have more than 2 million eggs. At 14 weeks, he or she can use facial expressions. In an ultrasound, you may see him sucking his thumb, and I can attest to this as well. Still legal to murder. At 16 weeks, hair is just beginning to form. You can tell the baby's sex. If you shine a flashlight on mommy's tummy, the baby will move away from the beam. You can start to feel the kick if you're the mother. Still legal. At 19 weeks is when many doctors recommend you start talking to the baby through your mom, through the mom's tummy, so that they'll be used to your voice. Still legal. At 22 weeks, he's basically a miniature newborn. There are a few processes that still need to develop. His lungs still need to develop. But otherwise, he's very much like a normal baby, very small. At 22 weeks, I'm sorry, that was 22 weeks. At 23 weeks, let's say something bad happens, and the baby is born prematurely. We're talking about a little less than 6 months at this point in the pregnancy. Let's say the baby is born prematurely. The baby has about a 1 in 5 chance of surviving outside the womb. 1 in 5. Still legal to murder. And as you go through the next week, that number goes up. The percentage of living goes up exponentially. At 24 weeks, more than half the babies will survive outside the womb. At 26 to 27 weeks, that number goes up to 90%. 90% of babies who are prematurely born here at, let's say, 6.5 months, 90% of them will survive outside the womb. And yet it's still legal to abort. And this is why it's so vital we strip away the smokescreen and we understand what we're talking about here. We are not talking about premature labor when we're talking about abortion. We're not talking about taking out a fetus that is not alive out of a mother's womb. We're talking about poisoning that baby. We're talking about dismembering that baby and then taking it out. Because you have to kill the baby before it comes out. Otherwise, it's considered murder. This is the cutoff point in California. The baby has started to open his eyes. And it's at this point California decides, okay, the baby's viable, meaning the baby can survive outside the womb. Therefore, it should be a little bit more difficult. No more smoke screens. No more curtains. No more sterile language. We're not talking about a cluster of cells. We're not talking about taking someone off of life support. Don't buy the prevailing narratives. Now, people who are pro-abortion will often bring up other distractions. They'll bring about, well, what about this? What about that? And I do feel that I need to address them quickly. The main one, specifically, is what if a woman is raped? Rape is one of the most heinous crimes anyone could ever commit. That doesn't justify murder. It doesn't justify murder. It doesn't justify murdering a third innocent party. It goes back to the very fundamental and very simple morality we learned as children, which is two wrongs don't make a right. Again, all of these are distractions. These what about this, what about that? They're distractions thrown up because we're not meant to talk about the real issue of what's going on. But if you look at it from a purely scientific perspective, the legality in our country is, well, it's unquestionably horrific. It's unquestionably immoral. But now let's talk about Scripture. Can anyone, before abortion, and also a Christian? I think we've already proven that you can't, but let's keep going. In Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 through 25, we see that the new laws are being formed. And there is some debate as to what exactly is being talked about here, but I believe that the way it's worded here in the NASB is very clear. It says, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. I believe this is an implementation of the death penalty for one who forces a miscarriage or a stillbirth. Does God view the unborn child as sacred, as living? You bet He does. Psalm 139, one of my favorite passages to go to. We're going to be reading it in its entirety tonight. Let me just read a few verses. Verse 13, it says, for you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. And again, I think this is Hebrew poetry discussing this idea of depths of the earth, the fact that we are... Well, there's many ways you could view it, but I do believe he's saying the depths of the womb, if not before that. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 17, we're told that God hates and considers an abomination hands that shed innocent blood. And when you pull the smokescreen out of the way, when you pull the curtain and you realize that abortion is not taking someone off of life support, that it does employ the forceful act of murder, well, then it's obvious that abortion is the shedding of innocent blood. And God considers this an abomination. Proverbs 31, verses 8 and 9 says, to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. Which brings us back to my question before. What can we do? What should we do? Well, number one, as is taking up the bulk of our time, we need to be educated on this. We need to be educated on this. We cannot buy into the prevailing narratives so that we can go out and that we can talk to other people, speaking the truth to those we meet. God presents us all with opportunities. One-on-one conversations. Women expecting mothers who may feel that they are overwhelmed. Women, young girls who may not know what the process is. And we may have a relationship with them in which we can discuss things. We can talk to them. And I don't want us to feel that a one-on-one conversation is not as valid as going on a march or doing a protest. Because that's still one life. Would you feel bad about yourself if you saw a kid walking in the street and nearly get hit by a car and you pulled him out of the way? Would you feel bad that you haven't saved all kids everywhere? No, you'd be happy that you saved one life. And I want us to all think that way in the fact that, again, just as in evangelism, one soul is worth the whole world. We save one life through a conversation with someone. We've done a great good. And that those numbers add up. The midwives, they saved the babies one at a time. And so can we. And so I hope that we will be talking to people. But we need to have information available. I'm not saying we go with a paper that has all the debate tactics, right? I'm saying we go with a general knowledge, with an understanding, and we also have a list of other options available to them. Our church has dealt with certain organizations. And I, again, number three, would encourage you to donate time and money to these organizations. There's one specifically that we've had dealings with in the past. And I hope that you'll go ahead and write this down, put this in your phone, have this information available, look this up later. There are options available to young women, but they don't know about them if no one's willing to tell them. So I'll give you a moment to write this down. Yeah, take a picture. There you go. That's a good idea. I also encourage you to, again, donate to these organizations. There are several out there. There are people who are on the front lines. There are places run by volunteer who actually give women free ultrasounds, who give them descriptions of and options available to them. There are organizations that will pay for all the expenses of the baby being born and will pay for all the expenses of getting the baby to a family that will love and nurture, a family that can't have children, a family that has been praying for that child. There are options available, and we need to have information ready to go. We need to be informed. Also, we need to be voting. Now, again, I said I'm not going to talk politics, and so I've already mentioned this in the past. There may be a way that you can vote that you feel will put an end to this. But again, it's not going to all end there. It's going to end when we change the heart of our country. We need to change the heart of our nation. But there is also the option of going about it in the political process. But that shouldn't be your only way. Far from it. Also, I encourage all of us to pray. Tonight, we're going to be having a prayer meeting on this very subject. We're going to pray not only that the laws get changed, but we're going to pray about the individuals who are faced with a tough decision. And the only reason it's tough is because they haven't been informed. Let's pray that they are informed. Let's pray that the smoke screen is stripped away from our society. That we stop wearing blinders. Let's pray that a fire starts within every church. That we will stop passing by the abortion clinic with no thought. Finally, I'd ask you to talk to your brothers and sisters here in this congregation. You may have opportunities, you may have ideas that I don't have. Talk to me about it. I want this to be the beginning of the conversation so that we can get organized, so that we can have a fire lit in us, so that we can start trying our best to change what is going on around us. So if you have opportunities, if you know someone who may be in a situation, talk to your brothers and sisters here. Ask for advice. Let's communicate with each other. Let's not let this sermon be the end of the discussion. It can't be. Now, I know this has been dark, to say the least. I know it's controversial, to say the least. And yet, for whatever reason, we in the church tend to ignore this subject. Oh, sure, we may mention it in passing to someone we know agrees with us. But if you really compare it to the great atrocities of the past, we have blinders on. You think the church, you think the first century church turned a blind eye to what the Spartans were doing, throwing babies off of cliffs? You think the first century church ignored any of that? I can't imagine them just going about their lives as genocide takes place. And yet that's what we do. I guess it's out of sight, out of mind. These babies don't have a voice. So who can cry out for them? Who will hear them? God hears them. Just as God heard the Israelites in their bondage, and He took notice of them, the same is true for these babies. God hears their cry. Do you? Do you hear their cry? I think a lot of us think we hear it. But then we become afraid. We're afraid of being maligned. We're afraid of being called a bad person. We're afraid of being called a religious zealot. We're afraid of being uncomfortable. Perhaps we're afraid of being unprepared in a discussion on this very subject. We're afraid of so many things, but what it boils down to is that we're more afraid of other people than we are of God. God's judgment will be terrible and swift. Again, I don't know what form it'll take. I don't know if it's going to happen before or after He comes back. But all I know is that I fear God. And I fear my eternal destination more than I fear anything on this earth. Fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Do you fear God or do you fear people? Fear God. The lesson is yours. We're going to offer an invitation. I know this lesson isn't one that would inspire most people to come down to the front, and I understand that. If you have anything you need, you can come. If you have any prayers that you would like to be offered on your behalf, the congregation is here. We're here to love you. Or maybe you've, in the past, maybe you've had an abortion. Maybe you know someone who did. Maybe you encouraged it for somebody else. Whatever the story is, we're here for you as well. Talk to someone that you're close to. Don't let this burden weigh heavy on your heart, because all of us have sinned. All of us are guilty in the eyes of God, but He loves us and He offers His Son and His blood, and that sheds us of all sin. And if you have let the sin of your past get in the way of turning to Him and accepting that blood, I want you to have no mind to it. God will take your sin and He'll cast it into the sea. So if you haven't come to Him, please come. As together we stand and sing.